Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. Today, you're going to be hearing about climate change and its effect on worker safety. Now, you may know something about the climate impacts that we'll have to prepare for. Higher temperatures, more extreme storms, more exposure to ticks and mosquitoes. But you may not have thought very much about how climate change impacts are going to affect workers, particularly workers who are exposed to and vulnerable to heat. Think about workers on farms or construction sites, or loading boxes in unair-conditioned warehouses. There's not a lot of research on this topic yet, but recently when I was in Washington, D.C., I had the chance to catch up with two people who know quite a bit about this. One is Sid Shapiro. He holds the Frank Fletcher Chair in Administrative Law at Wake Forest University, and he's a member scholar at CPR. And the other is Katie Tracy, a specialist in workers' rights and a policy analyst at CPR. Sid Shapiro and Katie Tracy completed a study just recently called Occupation Health and Safety, which will appear in an upcoming book that Professor Rosemary Lister and I have just completed editing. That book is called The Research Handbook on Climate Disaster. Well, this is sober stuff, but as we'll hear, there's a lot that we can do to tackle this challenge. So here's my interview, which took place in Washington, D.C. in late May with Sid Shapiro and Katie Tracy. Katie and Sid, thanks for being here today.
Our pleasure.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
So as you know, I've been researching climate impacts for a long time, and I have to say that there isn't a lot of literature on the climate impacts related to occupational hazards, certainly in the United States. And so I'm wondering if we could start by my asking, what are the sorts of risks that you're most concerned about when we're talking about occupational hazard and climate impacts?
We can get into that because it's very important, but if I can pick up on something with which you started, which is that there isn't much in the way of writing about the risk to workers because of climate change. But I think that's true in general. In the United States, because the workers who are at the most risk for being injured or even die from what happens in the workplace tend to be lower paid blue collar workers. It's a matter of out of sight, out of mind. For so many of us, we don't work in those occupations. We may not know anyone who works in those occupations. And so the fact that a worker might risk his or her life going to work every day is just something to which we pay little attention. So OSHA and its efforts to protect workers, I think, receives less attention than we really ought to pay to it.
So OSHA, being the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they're in charge of the federal standards, as you point out, for safety and workers, and yet you're right, we don't hear about them very much in the news, or it seems to me as citizens really follow what they do very much.
The other reason you might not have heard a lot about OSHA and workers and the risks of climate change is that OSHA's done very little about it. In fact, most states and federal agencies have done little to look ahead and start to protect workers from these dangers, which I know we haven't discussed yet.
Right.
But that also goes into why there's been so little written.
Well, let's get into that then. Katie, in the piece that you and Sid wrote on occupational safety and climate, you go through some of the main impacts from climate change that create some of the main risks. Can you unpack that a little bit? What are the problems that we're worried most about or should be worried most about?
So I think heat stress or exposure to excessive heat, especially for outdoor workers, is probably the most obvious hazard. But there are many other hazards as well, especially from extreme weather events. And as we know with climate change, those are going to become more frequent and more intense. So those hazards will also become a greater risk. We also have exposure to airborne pollutants and vector-borne illnesses from floodwaters, waterborne diseases. And so there's just a whole host of hazards that we're already aware of that will increasingly become more risky. And then we'll have new emerging risks that workers will also have to grapple with. We mentioned earlier the workers who would be exposed, and for outdoor workers, that's going to be construction workers, but we also have indoor risk for commercial kitchens, mining, smelters, and foundries.
Okay, so for workers outside, as you say, we're talking landscapers, construction workers, certainly people working in agriculture on farms, and then inside, as you point out, I was surprised to read in your paper about all of the heat stress that miners endure, and people who are loading boxes in large, unair-conditioned warehouses, for instance, and others. So let's pick up on the heat. I mean, you're right, that seems obvious. And I was looking up some of this information to just make sure I had the most recent data. And according to government studies here in the United States, the average temperature in the lower 48 has increased 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. And according to these same studies, frequency and intensity of extreme temperatures is said to be, quote, virtually certain to increase in the United States on the climate on the account of climate change. What specifically does heat do in an agricultural field or on a construction site? What are the physical medical risks that one runs by working in an area in which there's extreme heat?
So when you're outdoors and it starts to get hot, it's not just about the temperature itself, but it's about the humidity level as well. And when it's hot and humid and you're trying to do work, you start to, hopefully you start to sweat because that's how you would avoid heat stroke. But what happens is workers start to get very hot and then your cognitive functions start to decline. So it becomes harder to do the task you were already doing, which imposes more dangers of general safety risk to the workers outdoors.
Okay, so this is more than just what I would think of as physiological hazard of passing out, let's say, or of having some kind of heart trouble or something. You're actually saying that when your cognition is impaired, that you make other choices that might lead to some kind of a physical accident in which you're hurt.
Leads to fatigue, and so as we can discuss perhaps in more detail a bit later, workers are less productive in the heat, and they're particularly less productive if businesses don't take care to protect workers from the heat.
So in addition to medical issues that are related directly to the employees, you're saying that there actually might be economic damage that occurs as a result.
Yes, it could be extreme economic damage. Either way, when it comes to how employers respond to heat stress, workers are either going to have to take more breaks, which will result in lowered productivity, or they will have to extend working hours, and workers will have to take on the economic risk unless they get pay raises. So either way, there will be a shift in the economics, and it will just be a matter of how we respond to that, whether we put it on the companies who are responsible or the employees who aren't.
So how might the employees actually lose out economically? Is it because they're working or producing things more slowly and therefore being paid less as a result of that?
So there's two ways this could happen. One is if you're a farm worker who works for based on the quantity of what you pick, and it's very hot and you have to take breaks more often, then you have to work longer hours, or you get paid less because you weren't able to pick as much. Otherwise, the other option is that employers may extend the working hours, which takes away from your work-life balance.
Okay, so that's the heat. Now, I was noticing... go ahead.
Move on
go
from
ahead,
the Sid. Heat. You were asking about the fact that workers are not only endangered, their employers lose productivity. And the numbers are extraordinarily high. There was a study of workers in Germany that estimated the current loss of productivity due to heat impacts as between 771 and $3.4 billion a year. Estimates put productivity loss in the Caribbean and areas like Asia at 11 to 27% because of heat already. And there's even estimates that labor capacity is reduced 80 or 90% in the hottest months in the hottest places in the world. So this is a real problem for employers and obviously for employees.
That's huge. And now, as you say, we're just talking about the heat, which is just one of the impacts from climate.
There are actually a number of other side effects which we can get into, and I'm not sure whether those studies are based on all of those impacts or just heat alone.
I see.
But they're all related to heat.
So, right.
Heat is the ground floor of all these other effects.
Well, now you too write in your paper, and I'm going to quote here, you say substantial economic dislocation is also likely. As the economy begins the transition to greener industries, some employers or even whole industries may disappear while new industries emerge. And so this is not just economic decline in certain sectors, but as you write, dislocation. Can you explain that a little bit?
So I think a really good example of this is what we're seeing with the coal industry. The industry is starting to disappear, to decline, because we're moving toward more renewable energy sources like solar. And so we're seeing a decline in that industry. But even if we see an increase of jobs in these new renewable energies, the workers from the coal industry will lose their jobs. So we have to put them on a path to transition to new jobs. We can't just leave them behind.
Okay. This sounds a little bit, it certainly sounds like a bad news story, but if I could, okay, being a little creative, it seems like a bad news, good news story in the following way. The bad news is that we have these climate impacts that are coming down the pike that are happening actually right now, and they're going to result in medical problems with workers and with economic problems for the country and for the workers as well. That's the bad news. It seems to me the good news, if you're looking for a silver lining, is that these problems, heat stress, and you write in your paper, air pollution in occupational hazard, as an occupational hazard, UV exposure, ultraviolet radiation exposure, as an impact. These are all things that we're familiar with. If not at the scale that you're talking about, they're issues that we're already familiar with. And so the question I guess I have is, don't we already have a legal regime that to some degree is sensitive to the issues of heat stress and air pollution and UV radiation and the rest? Do we already have the infrastructure in place that we could build on?
Yes and no. Certainly all of these various problems that get worse in the heat, whether it's increased air pollution, whether it's more insects who pose health risks, whether it's heat stress itself, there are regulatory agencies across the government and the states as well, that have responsibilities of protecting citizens from all these kinds of risks. So to that extent, it is a good news story. But the no is that we're not doing a very good job of addressing existing risks. And one of the key points of our paper is that these risks are going to get worse as climate changes and as heat rises. So we're not doing what we need to do now, and we're going to have to do that and more in the future.
So how would an agency like OSHA address the problem of heat extremes for, let's say, farm workers?
OSHA could easily adopt a heat stress standard to protect workers from the excessive heat they're exposed to. Unfortunately, OSHA has not. And
wait, I want to stop you there. You're saying that OSHA doesn't have a standard right now for exposure to extreme heat?
Nope, no standard at all. There's been an effort to propose a standard. They at one point formed an advisory committee to formulate a standard, but never adopted the standard. Groups have petitioned OSHA to adopt a standard and even helped write a draft standard, but again, OSHA chose to not adopt the standard. So they have some piecemeal regulations in place that help to address some of the heat risk, but they none of the standards actually say anything about climate change or heat specifically.
And there's no national standard that says that when the temperature hits a certain level that workers can't be outside?
There's no standard like that, except for the military, which actually does have standards for our soldiers.
Okay. And what about, isn't there a rule, an OSHA rule about accessibility to drinking water? I mean, if you're working in a construction site or in the fields or something like that?
Yes, they do have a standard on having access to drinking water, but unfortunately it doesn't say exactly how often you need to have water available, how frequently you need to take breaks to drink the water, and it doesn't say anything about the specific heat-related risk.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots. Today we're talking about climate change impacts and worker safety with Sid Shapiro and Katie Tracy. Let's take a short break.
Hi, this is David Flores, policy analyst for the Center for Progressive Reform. When floodwaters recede, toxic contamination remains. Runoff from a scrapyard leaves lead dust on city sidewalks. At CPR, we're working on the pollution sources that you can't see and that the government regulators aren't looking for. Visit our Toxic Floodwaters Project on CPR's website and take a trip with us through Virginia's communities and waterways, from the state's highlands to its tidewater. And we'll take a look at how climate change and lax industrial regulation threaten public safety and our economy.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots. We're talking about climate change impacts and worker safety with Sid Shapiro, a professor of law at Wake Forest University and a member scholar at CPR, and Katie Tracy, a specialist in workers' rights and a policy analyst at CPR. What should OSHA be doing? You're making the case that we don't have the legal structure that we would need. Do we have the information that we would need to know what the effects of heat stress and all the rest are on workers and what would be a good thing to do to combat that problem?
We do. As Katie said, the Armed Forces actually is fairly advanced on this. And you can turn to medical science that tells you how often people should have breaks, how much water they should consume. The availability of shade is important. The first two are less effective if you're standing in the direct hot sun while you're drinking water and trying to cool down. So some sort of shade would be necessary. If you are a farm worker, it may be necessary to have tents or other such facilities at the farm field, perhaps fans. So these are all changes which we could make to do this. The fact is the body can adapt to doing a reasonable amount of work in hot weather, but only if it's treated properly and not put under undue stress.
What are states doing a better job at this?
There are currently three states that have standards on heat stress. California is leading the way on heat stress with an outdoor heat standard, but also a new indoor heat standard. So they've been making significant progress.
Of the infrastructure we have, the legal infrastructure we have for protecting workers at the national scale, are we good at enforcing those rules? It seems in your paper, you make the case that we're not, you know, to be frank, and that we don't know about as many violations as we should in the workplace that endanger workers. Why is that, do you think?
OSHA has, for the reasons perhaps we discussed earlier in our discussion, been fairly beleaguered and underfunded as an agency. And so one of the consequences of that is it has far too few inspectors to really inspect workplaces and make sure that its regulations are being obeyed. And it same goes for the Washington staff because of the small size of the agency, which is shrinking under budget cuts. There aren't enough people left to turn out a lot of regulations, and so OSHA is very slow in getting to the next problem that it probably should address. And so although, as Katie said earlier in the interview, it's known about this problem for years and years, it still hasn't been able to do anything about it in terms of turning to this problem versus other things to which it's attending.
And I'll just add to what Sid said, that OSHA does have a voluntary initiative, a heat stress campaign that they roll out every summer to try and raise awareness on the issue. And they even have an app that employers and employees can use to find out the heat index near them. And it has a whole list of precautions they can take. But the only way that OSHA can enforce any heat stress standard or any heat stress hazards that workers experience is through what is called the General Duty Clause. Under the General Duty Clause, it's aptly named for requiring employers to protect workers from known hazards and risk, even if OSHA doesn't have a standard. But OSHA doesn't use that authority very often because they have a pretty high bar to prove their cases. So what happens is that they can issue this, but I think it's in 2012, there were multiple deaths, but OSHA only issued General Duty Clause citation 17 times that year for heat stress.
I see. It occurs to me another obvious point is that of the people who are working in these areas that are prone to heat stress, whether it's agricultural fields or it's construction sites or it's people putting on the roof on a house, these are folks that are often immigrants. They're often people who are vulnerable in a number of legal ways, I suppose, and aren't going to be the first folks who are going to, I suppose, blow the whistle, right?
Well, that's true, because in many ways these are very undesirable jobs. You're working outside. If you are a farm worker, you're exposed to pesticides. It's stoop work, it's hand work. And I think the agricultural industry has found over the years it's simply unable to hire Americans to do that work. And so it tends to be immigrants and other people who've come to this country to do that work. They're probably the least educated and with the least power among workers to do something, even if they think they are exposed to hazards that are dangerous to themselves.
I'll just add that when it comes to heat stress or any of the other hazards that workers face on the job, one of the problems that immigrants face is that their employers often threaten them, especially if they're undocumented, with deportation. They say, if you're going to raise a hazard, we'll call ICE. So workers don't feel comfortable speaking up or working with law enforcement or even OSHA officials because of this problem.
So this becomes an issue of social inequality among many other issues, right? It's about climate, it's about economics, the economics of industry and farming, but it's also about class. and socially vulnerable people.
Absolutely, and that's why in the solution to this problem and how we address climate change, we have to consider this in how we design those solutions.
Well, what might a good set of solutions look like? If we had a set of lawmakers, either in a large state like California or a set of lawmakers in Congress who are interested in addressing this problem, what would you suggest?
We can take the kind of steps that we discussed earlier by way of protecting workers, whereby employers adapt their workplace to the change in working conditions. And that means protecting their workers by, as we discussed, more frequent breaks, shade, water, resting, hats, and other kinds of protections, such as changing the hours of the day in which people work to cooler times of the day.
Well, I want to go back then to something that Katie and I were talking about earlier. I had asked that question about whether substantial economic dislocation is likely because of climate impacts making certain outdoor jobs harder to perform, and I guess we could say more expensive to perform. But it sounds like, Sid, when you're talking about the driver of what many people would call substantial economic dislocation, which is not producing the fossil fuels that we have in the past and consuming them the way that we have in the past.
Well, that's right. So the good news for workers that particularly are outdoors, if we can start to reduce greenhouse gases, we could mitigate the amount of heat rise in climate change. And that's just better off for them because they're less exposed to drastic levels of heat. At the same time, the regulatory actions or even voluntary actions we take to reduce greenhouse gases means that there's going to be economic disruption in industries which particularly contribute to greenhouse gases. And one example is coal mining, which economic trends are causing to decline anyway, but that decline will be hastened as we move to more reliance on renewable energy. And the workers that work in industries such as oil and gas production and coal, there's going to be less jobs there, and they're going to be adversely affected economically.
So this doesn't sound like it's good news for workers in these sectors, no matter how you slice it. What's the solution to that?
Well, the solution is that we have to pay attention to it. If we ignore these changes, then we're leaving those workers on their own to try to make some sort of transition to more and better employment, or at least employment. But as we see, for example, in areas of Appalachia where coal mining has decreased, workers, for various reasons, are stuck in those regions. There's very little economic development. There are no replacement jobs, or the replacement jobs don't pay very well. And we've created these huge swaths of poverty in those areas, and workers are left without any way out. So we need government policies that try to revitalize those areas. It's something we owe the workers. We'd all benefit as a nation from reducing the degree of climate change. It's worth billions and billions of dollars to us to do so in avoided damages. And we need to be aware of these workers and offer them new opportunities and help create new infrastructure in their areas to help build a replacement economy.
As I have been interviewing folks in this series about climate change impacts, I always try to ask one question toward the end. I'm going to ask you, Katie, if that's okay. Do you see any ray of hope in any of this? Are there any things that make you feel hopeful?
So I think there's good news here. This can actually be a win-win. As we transition to the renewable energy sector and solar and wind, we'll actually see an increase in jobs. There will be more job opportunities. So as long as we put in place the policies to help workers, everybody can come out of this better than before. So there is already principles, what's called the Just Transition Movement, that will help us get there. We just need to put it into legislation and policy at the state, federal, international, all levels of government.
Katie Tracy, Sid Shapiro, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And that concludes my interview on climate change and worker safety, held earlier this year at Georgetown's Melrose Hotel in Washington, D.C. My guests were Sid Shapiro of Wake Forest University and Katie Tracy, policy analyst at CPR. Our music today was by Lobo Loco. Take care.
You've been listening to Connect the Dots podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center helping to build healthy communities, safe workplaces, and a more resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website, www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.